My name is Barbara Schneider, and I'm president of the World Affairs Council. And this afternoon, it's my pleasure to be able to introduce my very good friend, Ambassador Jim Cragin. I think we're in for a real treat this afternoon. Jim and I were on the Chamber's Cuba trip together last month. Quite a few people from that trip are here today. Can't hear me in the back? Can't hear. Help with the sound. The Center for International Studies, the University of the Incarnate Word. He is also vice chair of the World Affairs Council, and he is just back from a wonderful World Affairs Councils of America conference in Washington, D.C., where he represented our council very well. And he'll be telling you a little bit about that later in his presentation, too. Jim is a career diplomat for over 30 years and has been both a university professor and a college president. He's a guest scholar at the University of Notre Dame, lecturing on diplomatic and foreign policy issues. He served his country under 8 presidents, beginning at the Agency for International Development under President John F. Kennedy. He was named U.S. Ambassador to Honduras by President Clinton in 1996. And he was awarded the highest honor of the Republic of Honduras for his efforts and those of the United States government to save lives and rebuild the country following Hurricane Mitch in 1998. And he has some really amazing stories about that experience, too. He has made an honorary Honduran citizen, and he, as you can imagine, has received many, many prestigious awards. He has been honorary president of the American Chambers of Commerce in Sao Paulo, Brazil, and in Honduras, and vice president of Brazil's American Society. He serves on the board of the Latin American Advisory Council of the University of Notre Dame. He was born in Ohio, is a 1962 graduate of the University of Notre Dame, and has received his PhD from the University of Virginia. He speaks Spanish, Portuguese, and Italian, and is listed in Who's Who in America and the World. We couldn't have a better person here to tell us about our experiences in Cuba, and I would like now to bring Jim up to the podium. Please welcome Jim Cragin.
Thank you, Barbara. So is this one going to work? Or do I? We'll try from here. And thank you. The great introduction. Not really true. If you want to know who ran the U.S. Embassy in Honduras, or the Consulate General in São Paulo, or our embassy to Rome, or our embassy to the Holy See, she's sitting right there. Her name is Gwen Cragin, and I just did what she told me to do. It's great to be here, and I just can't believe, but it doesn't have anything to do with grades. Actually, my students, some of them, and former students are sitting over here, so I'm really honored that you guys would come back and hear, it won't be a lecture, but anyway, to hear. And I'm proud to be professor and all those things Barbara said, sort of half, because I thought I retired from Incarnate Word in May, but obviously I didn't, because I'm still teaching courses there, and I'm really proud to be doing that and honored to be with the university. So, Senator and Chairman, Barbara, President, and all of you who were with us on that famous trip to Cuba, you want to show you stand so the people know who you are, wave or something, those who went on this this trip? A bunch of us. I can tell you, there's a bunch of us. So any one of them could be our lady or our man in Havana to talk to you, but I'm the one picked to do that today, and I'm not going to go through the slides while I'm talking, because obviously you're going to look at the slides, and that's okay. And maybe we'll come back to them. But there are some terrific ones. Goa, thank you for all your photographic abilities. And Margot, you took a bunch of them. And who else? They were beautiful, your photos. Some of them I want to point to if you haven't seen them, because they're, for example, I'm just going to spot at some point photo of our U.S. residents, ambassador's residents in Havana, Cuba, and that gives you an idea of it, because I think it's indicative of the past, but also the future. This was built so that Franklin Roosevelt could come down and visit. That was the word then, back in 1938-39, with this incredible coral. And it is nothing. Well, I've never seen a better embassy for the kinds of things that diplomacy is useful for. Receptions, dinners, diplomatic influence, discussions, all those things. It was the good neighbor policy of Franklin Roosevelt. So this beautiful residence was built. We have not an ambassador to Cuba because, you know, we broke relations and then we have this kind of half relationship. We are sometimes I talk like I'm still in government, but anyway, you know what I mean. Anyway, we are, that is the U.S. interest section of the Embassy of Switzerland. But basically, in recent years, we've sort of dropped, for, you know, ease of discussion, the Embassy of Switzerland part. So we are just the U.S. interest section. And the person who's running it is called principal officer, but by in any other place, ambassador. We also have a large embassy building in downtown Havana. I don't think we have photos of that because, you know, it doesn't exist kind of thing. We zip by it. There used to be these big posters outside insulting the U.S., and then we would have posters insulting back, and, well, we've given up on that, which is kind of nice. So you can see the building. But, I mean, we are complete with Marines and everything. So when the time comes, that relationship is ready to go. I've got a couple notes here because I can't, you know, otherwise I ramble. They get the picture. I know there's something else I was going to say. Forgive me, and we'll come back to it. And I hope there's lots of questions and answers, because that's what we want to do. And Barbara, we've got about a half hour. Is that right? Okay. I always run off. Remind me, class is over. I don't have with me. Some of you might have the... And I sometimes do have with me, I did in Washington this week, the Texas flag lapel. Do you know that the Estrella Solitaria, the lone star in the Cuban flag, which looks kind of interestingly like the Texas flag, that lone star was inspired by Texas? Not everybody will agree to that today, but when the first Cuban flags... They were under Spanish domination until 1898, till the U.S. war against Spain. First Cuban flags being put together way back in 1848. You can see pretty close to when Texas was still a republic. And so that star is kind of interesting because it's kind of a contact there. Oh, by the way, please ask me after about the World Affairs meetings in Washington, because they were very interesting, and I think it's indicative of the importance of the World Affairs Councils here and there, and we had representatives from around the country, and we dealt with the really big issues in the world today. And I'll tell you a little bit about the speakers as well if a question comes forth. But what really disappointed me is that none of those big issues were Latin America. And we know here the importance of Latin America. We're going to have the anniversary of NAFTA coming right up this week. And so, and way beyond that, we know what's happening in Brazil and so forth. So I'm sure next year they're going to focus again on that. Now, first I wrote down, I'm not your man in Havana. Those of you who read the Graham Greene novel or saw the Alec Guinness movie, you know that he was a vacuum cleaner salesman. And he kind of, you know, did these things, sent back diagrams. Anyway, they thought it was kind of prescient because they thought it was some kind of bomb, perhaps. And that was in 58, I think, when the book was written. But I knew, I did stay at a Holiday Inn Express. No, we did stay at the Havana Libre, and we can talk about that too because it has a special history. This was a hotel. I'm saying this was a hotel built by Hilton, Conrad Hilton. 1958 opened the most splendid hotel in Cuba. Bad, bad timing. Because in January 1, 1959, Castro came into Havana. He did not like, he's the kind of guy that some would call a resentido in Spanish. Now, he did not particularly like the United States and its relationship, if you will, with the Cuba of Batista. And, you know, that all categorized by Meyer Lansky and the casinos and all of that. So he set up offices on the 23rd floor of the Havana Hilton, which became immediately Havana Libre, and the troops bivouacked, and, well, it hadn't been the same since. A note on the election, by that I mean the U.S. election, And Gwen and I were in Washington this week, as I say, one of the things being the World Affairs Council. Cuban Americans, because if you think about Cuba and U.S.-Cuba policy, you got to think about Cuban Americans. And in fact, I probably have it in my notes later, but you have to think now about Cuba-U.S. policy as highly domestic, almost not a foreign policy issue in the traditional sense, highly domestic. Both for the U.S. and for Cuba. Cuban Americans voted 49%, maybe even 50% for Obama. So it was probably, it's 49-49. That's a tremendous change. It was 29% for John Kerry in 2004 and even less prior to that. 60 to 70% of the Cuban Americans went for Obama if they were born in the U.S. 72% and up, I don't know the total percentage because they were, remember Florida, they still counting? But it's 72% and up for Romney if they had been born in Cuba. So a very deep generational thing. President Obama put into effect policies which were controversial in that community. That's what we're talking about, is that particular community and as centered in Miami. One of those policies that we could observe a little bit is that family members can travel to Cuba as they wish, basically, instead of only once in 3 years. So that's huge for people and for families. Another thing is remesas, or the remittances that they can send back, basically unlimited as well for families. So that's huge for those in Cuba and for those in the U.S., but also controversial, as I say, especially with those who had their properties taken and who had to leave the Cuba of Castro. And then another of those policy changes, I say change because these policies were basically extant under President Clinton, then changed again under President Bush, some of that again being Republican-Democratic policies and Cuban-American and so forth, and then back under Obama. One of those policies, and so I said travel of family members, I said remesas or remittances, and groups like our Chamber of Commerce group, which traveled to Cuba, that basically has been opened and expanded. And that includes students going to study on credit programs. This election may then, could mean, obviously there's some other priorities like fiscal cliffs and things like that, but it could mean the end of the embargo. and we'll talk about that, I hope, a little bit later, 5 minutes or so from now. The embargo that Secretary George Shultz called an insane policy. Of course, he was Ronald Reagan's Secretary of State, so really Rock Rib Republican. Remember that the U.S. and Cuba cooperate anyway, in spite of the difficult relationship. One, on drug addiction. The Cubans in the United States see eye to eye on drug addiction. Cubans, and by Cubans, you always meant Fidel Castro, and then now it's more committee. It's Raul Castro and the committee. Because, you know, Raul is running things. Fidel called him my relief pitcher. So the pitcher is in, I think, to stay. But drug interdiction, don't like it. We fight it. They fight it. We work together on it. An immigration agreement. I think it's the only Latin American country with which the United States has an agreement on immigration. All of that had to do with the floods of Cubans to the U.S. at different times, the danger of the waters, the need to cooperate, and so we do, and we have regulated immigration then from Cuba. And then agricultural sales. I mean, we are, in some recent years, we have been the number one agricultural supplier to Cuba. Pretty weird, because you've got an embargo. It was on the basis of cash and carry, you know, no credit. But if you look at chicken, you look at corn, wheat, and other things, even some rock lobster that we probably ate while we were there, comes from the U.S. In this cash position. Not surprising to politicians, Senator, but both Democrats and Republicans from farm states like that policy and push for that agricultural policy of selling to Cuba and also for liberalizing it. And I note that Republicans like Jeff Flake of Arizona has put in bills that basically, you know, you have a lot of that language, that legal language that goes into laws, but basically it's that oil produced offshore in Cuban waters could come into the U.S., you know, without the embargo. It didn't pass because they had opposition. But anyway, those are things that are happening. Cuba subsists on, one, oil from Hugo Chavez. So that key, without that, we would have seen a state really in sad trouble, crashing. Two, tourism. And that may be a couple billion dollars now. Very, very important. And we were part of this group that went to Cuba, part of a parallel economy. I mean, we were participating in, after all, we were eating pretty good meals and drinking pretty good mojitos. And we were traveling on Chinese buses, pretty good Chinese buses. And we dealt with the people that we were permitted to deal with, basically, in our sector, and that was education and artistic and so forth. That's pouring in a lot of money. Canadians are going there, and others are going there, the Europeans, and there's a lot of beach activity. So that's a lot of money. There are over a million Canadians that travel to Cuba each year, and I don't believe they're all Canadians either. But that's one of the ways to go down. Number two is the U.S., because now that we have family members going back, some of the things that we did, yeah, that's important, but basically you got family members going back, that's over 600,000. So, I mean, that's a lot of visitors there. Number three is Italy, because Italians travel. They go over, and there may be 70,000, and then Spain and so forth. So that's really important. So oil from Chavez, tourism, which is real, after all. Oil from Chavez isn't exactly real, because that can stop any time. It's all ideological and political. But the tourism is real. Three, these remesas, and we know about a lot of other countries. We talk about Mexico and others. We know the importance of the remittances coming from people in the U.S. back to other countries. We know worldwide the importance of that. What is it, $300 billion-plus money flowing from those in Europe or in the U.S. and so forth back to their home countries. So in Cuba, that's now very big. Could always be cut off, but I doubt it. Now, times are changing fast. So remesses are put, and that could be going toward $2 billion. And then something they actually extract and sell, and so that's the traditional kind of product, nickel. Nickel going to Alberta, Canada, basically, and for processing there. The used to be sugarcane, and that, of course, especially when they had the Soviet relationship, millions and millions of tons. Fidel Castro tried to get 10 million tons of sugar harvest. That was always failing. You really can't do things quite that way with total focus on one product without harm to the rest. This total mobilization stuff doesn't work so well. And then when the Soviet Union collapsed, there went the market and the equipment. And, well, it's sad. Those of us, we saw the sugar cane. We saw some of the processing. But they've gone from never made 10, but 8 million tons down to like 1.8 million tons this last year. And so we saw fields overgrown and sad. I have a solution for the future. You know, when things are working out well in Cuba, and I suppose if I'm going to tell you, then I won't get any, what do you call it, rewards for it. But anyway, ethanol, sugar cane for ethanol, like Brazil does, but with the efficiency that Brazil does, that could be the future. Another future likely is oil. They've got Repsol out there. They've got the Spanish out there. They have Gazprom. Of course, the Russians are out there. PDVSA, the Venezuelans are out there. Petrobras, the Brazilians are out there. The U.S., in some way, I think, is out there. And so things are going to happen, I believe. You know, after we're sort of past Fidel and Raul Inc., okay, what our group saw, and again, I want to thank the chamber people, Richard Pettis and Margo Fuentes and Tuesday and all you guys who just did a fantastic job with the organization of that trip. I'm going to try to jump over quickly. The things we saw, you would have seen going past you. Havana Vieja was really a high point. There's, of course, still the residents. But here we had an elegant colonial, recognized by the world, city. Havana is often called the Rome of the Americas, and there's reason for that. I mean, that architecture, the capital, now lying unused, but I think someday it could really be active again. Legislatures are useful, correct, Senator? So. Fidel Castro doesn't need one, but as he himself said, the Cuban model doesn't work even for Cuba anymore. So presumably there'll be a model that includes a very active legislature. But you see in Old Havana, UNESCO tries to save it, gorgeous town. It's, you know, colonial, it's Baroque, it's got everything. It's got the, well, Café del Oriente, a paladar now, with these new private restaurants. It's got the Bodega, you know, Del Medio. It's got the Floridita. It's got all the places Hemingway hung out, which I don't know. They're just there because Hemingway hung out there. But it's got incredible architecture, recognized as such. And I think we hope, because I think one of the sad things for us was to see the crumbling of that architecture. Then there's the cars. I think Russian has seen, we got lots of cars that we've seen. There are 60 to 100,000 semi-functioning U.S. cars from the 50s primarily, but even before. And they're marvelous, and they're held together, and, you know, who knows how, because don't have the parts. But that's something you see, and something that maybe in the future will also be continue to be important. There are other cars around there that are the workhorses, but not so nice as the Ladas. The biggest car you see is an old Fiat 124, as made in Tolyattigrad. He was the secretary of the Communist Party of Italy, and they built a factory in Soviet Union and called it Tolyattigrad and built Fiats. And you see them. They're from the 70s, 80s, and they're around. You see an odd BMW. I saw one gorgeous BMW go by. That, of course, is a diplomat's car, and they don't sell them. They have to take them back out. So you don't see those. Or they end up, if not a private car, perhaps in the kind of quiet elite government motor pool, which some of the some of the families might actually be able to enjoy. The buses, of course, were the workhorses, these really good, solid, even nice Chinese buses, and that makes that tourism industry work. The buses are good and fast. It depends on the driver, of course. One of the things you get into when you're on these kinds of things is competition. And we had the same Chinese buses, but we had a better driver, and we used to always beat the Germans to the next place. That's what happens when you're... The countryside. And some you will have seen... There, of course, these autos come up. The countryside, rich, tropical, green, overgrown, again, had been dedicated to sugar or not. In decline. So while there's beauty there, it's sad to see, oxen and the plow and the man behind the plow and some really basic, rudimentary old Soviet tractors that are coming apart. That's kind of difficult to see. That could all change. It's rich country, but not being used much. And of course, we saw the tobacco sweatshops. We weren't allowed to take photos in there for obvious reasons, because it was really sweatshop. But we also saw other kind of more touristy, rustic, fun, all-purpose cigar makers and others. We were at the Pearl of the South, Cienfuegos, a city kind of untouched by much of the... it almost seems untouched by the negative side of the revolution. So Cienfuegos is just a beautiful, beautiful city. And they, again, this is, you know, primarily for tourists, but what was it, Palacio del Valle, just a gorgeous old private person's house with a Moorish influence. And, you know, we enjoyed it. There is a separation. The Cubans don't necessarily enjoy it. They don't necessarily... have access to the internet or the kinds of communications that in these days we hope everybody has, but I think that will change as well. Remember, we were on, and then I could talk about the artists. We've seen the Cuba's Gaudi. We've seen many photos of artists and monuments, because we went. To Che's monuments in Santa Clara, to Che's grave, and so forth. Remember, we were on educational exchange. First, we could tell we were different from tourists, say, to Puerto Vallarta or tourists to Punta Cana or something in the Dominican Republic, because it took us a two-day trek to get to Cuba. It's a 30-minute flight. But because of the special circumstances, because we have to fly a charter from Miami, because you have to get into Miami the night before, it takes time to get there. So that tells you right away it's a little special, the getting there. We can be proud of being legal. Not everybody in Washington, when I told them I had been in Cuba, believed me. but we were... Did something go? No. But we were certainly legal. And we were, let's see, we were legal as long as we, quote, adhered to a full-time schedule of educational exchange activities, resulting in meaningful interaction between travelers, that would be us, and individuals in Cuba, quote, consistent with 31 CFR 515.565, paragraph B, subsection 2. Relating to the program with artists, educators, dance groups, singers, musicians, etc., etc. We were not allowed to have prominent, whatever that means, prominent activity on behalf of, quote, prohibited officials of the government of Cuba or prohibited members of the Communist Party of Cuba, end quote. Now, we saw a lot of Che, but he's dead, so that was okay. So if you thought that U.S. citizens have a constitutional right to travel wherever we want to, think again. The courts have given Congress the power to limit travel, and it has done so. So that's one thing, that program, something we may see and I think should see change for the good not just of us, the travelers, but certainly for the good of the Cubans, that there be more traveler by us. And by the way, they like Americans, you know. Strangely, the Cubans I was with, they always liked us. They liked me, you're American, they know I'm American, you know what I mean? And they would always have comments, bad comments, negative comments about Russians. Assuming, I guess, that, you know, we still had this animosity or something with us. And so be it. There's the economic embargo, which in Cuba is called the bloqueo, the blockade. Now, a blockade is actually an act of war. We remember, some of us, the tensions for good reason in 1962 when we came close to nuclear war. President Kennedy didn't want to say blockade. He said quarantine. We're quarantining the Soviet ships so that they turn around and go back, because a blockade is an act of war. That quarantine stopped traffic into Cuba. But, you know, the embargo is us choosing not to trade. Cuba can trade with whomever they wish. Now, we do have exceptions in our not trading with Cuba. I already mentioned agriculture, medicine, and so forth. But it is why I know so many of us wanted to bring back the rum and cigars. But we had to smoke and drink them in Cuba. And that's because of the embargo. We don't want to help Cuba with our purchases. We think, anyway, it's a long story. So the embargo obviously hurts Cuba. Just very, very quick, I've got 2 pages left of these little notes that I scribbled down when our American Airlines flight from Washington was delayed. And remember that there was a period of Spanish domination, right? Okay, then 1898, Spanish-American War. U.S., call it domination, whatever you like, U.S. domination, until the Batista's overthrow and the Castro Revolution, that's 1959. By 1960, because Castro made certain that there would be this implacable animosity between the U.S. and Cuba, by 1960, the Russians came in, and then it's Russian domination and support, if you like to say, until 1990 when Russia collapsed. Then there's that awful special period, which our gentle guides remembered, and everybody remembers the 1990s. Horrible time. Gwen and I were there on State Department activities then, and people just didn't have enough to eat, period. Famine, very bad. By 1999, Hugo Chavez came along and in essence, bailed out again. So meantime, this embargo goes on. The disaster of the Cuban economy, of course, isn't the embargo. It's Castro's fault. He's the perfect caudillo. And if you want to mess up an economy, have a dictator or a caudillo decide things like that. Arbitrary. It's all about being arbitrary. At one point in the 90s, remember Gwen, they opened up private restaurants. You could have 12 seats. But then he thought, some people are getting richer than they ought to be. So closed it down again. To me, the classic story, not quite on the embargo, is, and I've just forgotten his name, but this was a Cuban. Most of the baseball players in the States were Cubans back when. And he was a star of the 1955 World's, 1955, when Brooklyn Dodgers beat the New York Yankees, and he made this fantastic catch, and he was a star. Anyway, he went back to Cuba in 1960, and Fidel said, you know, you're really good. I want to make you the manager of the Cienfuegos baseball team, because they had teams by province. And the guy said, geez, that's quite an honor, but I really don't want to be manager of the Cienfuegos team. Okay. Lost his car, lost his house, lost his money. Fidel prevented him from traveling. See, it's all personal animosity. He finally got out in one of the waves of people leaving, but I just... you know, just kind of get you. One last comment on the embargo, which means tying our hands in dealing with Cuba. Colin Powell's chief of staff called it the stupidest foreign policy ever. These are both the Republicans. Okay, change will come on the Cuba side. We on our trip saw a little bit of it. Private restaurants again called Paladares. We saw actually signs up saying house for sale, se vende. They're now able to sell a house, not to everybody, but to one another. of course, the tourism sector that I talked about, and so things are slowly changing. I pointed out the U.S. government is ready. We need to change. Cold War is over. How will change come? Most everybody. And in, when we were in Washington this week, we talked to people who had been former U.S. principal officers in Havana. And almost everybody uses the word, especially when you're at that ambassador's residence, for example, and who knows who's listening. The word we generally use is change will come with biology. So Fidel's 86, and he was able to prove the other day that he's alive. People were saying, Fidel's dead. But then he showed up in a van with a manager of the Hotel Nacional, and it said, retiree Fidel Castro meets with president with the manager of hotel, and then Fidel was holding up today's newspaper, the Gramna, with the today's date, so you know that's him. Well, in any case, biology will take over, and then we'll have to see how that political change occurs. Probably, there are lots of guesses. I talked to people who were principal officers or ambassadors there 10 years ago, and they say 10 years ago we knew exactly how the change would occur. We knew what would happen. Now we don't. But it could be, one can see the way Raul, one can see committee. I mean, he's defense. He's got he's got a group that could be a committee of transition. We thought it would be generational, but the 50-somethings who were important at one time, foreign minister and other, the head of the economic program, have been eliminated. So it's the old generation is not yet ready to give it to the 50-somethings, but there will be change and could be that way. Others say, well, it'll be like the PRI was in Mexico. You know, there'll be some kind of controlling mechanism, maybe the Chinese model. Wait, nobody knows yet, but something. The most, what'll be of great importance to us that we must watch, and I recommend that you read or pick up or a book by a blogger. Cuban bloggers are tremendous now. Yoani Sanchez. She has a book, 2009, but I think again in 2011, Inveterate Blogger, which means she gets picked up, gets arrested, gets released, gets arrested, but all about human rights, you know, why can't we have internet, why can't we do this? Yoani Sanchez, it's called, came out in Italian as Havana Libre, in English I think it's Havana Real. Fascinating. It shows you the human rights side of things, which must change, and we have to keep pressure on to make a change, but that doesn't mean keeping embargo on helps make a change. I think for our policies, we need to think what's in the U.S. Economic interest, and I think more economic activity with Cuba and more tourism with Cuba, maybe not only in accordance with CFR 315, come on, give us the freedom to travel. More travel to Cuba, there will be pressure to change. I think I got to quit, and I hope we have some questions that I can answer or not, or at least have a dialogue, because, as I said in the beginning, I'm not your man in Havana. I've been there, but and it affected every country that Gwen and I were in Latin America, whether it was Peru, Brazil, Salvador, Honduras, Mexico. Always Cuba was a part of things. And I'll conclude. It's 1992, but it's ever more true today. I was in 1992 the senior advisor for Latin America. I was an old guy there. Senior advisor for Latin America at the United Nations. One of my jobs was to get people on board to agree with us that this embargo against Cuba was important and would help bring down the Castro regime. Now, at that point, 40 years had gone by, you know, now more. So we had a public member, Gloria Estefan, those who remember the Miami Sound Machine, Gloria Estefan was there. And she would sing and I would dance and we would try to convince the Latin American ambassadors and the others in the world to agree with us on the importance of this. So I thought we were making headway because they loved this show. I think they liked the singing, but anyway, they liked the show. We'd have them out for whatever, drinks and what. Time for vote came. It was can't remember how many members in the U.S., something like 183 votes against the U.S. position, against the embargo, and three in favor. Well, the first vote was easy. It was ours. So we got for the second was Israel. That, too, is kind of it. And the third, I can't remember. It was one of the stands, and I remember there was some kind of deal-making and some Colombian was involved. I don't know what happened. But we got their vote. Now we usually only get the two. That tells you something. I think Schultz was right. Insane policy, or stupid policy, as Colin Powell's deputy said. But we will see. We have to work in the U.S. interest. We have to work for our economic interests, which also is in the mutual interest, at least of the Cuban people. And at the same time, we've got to work very hard on the human rights side, because that's we're not there yet. Well, that's about all I know. So thank you very much, and let's have questions. And if you want to hear about World Affairs Council Washington, too, I can say
that. Yes, I've got a quick question about that. I understand you were in Washington for the World Affairs Council meeting, and you had dinner last week with General Petraeus. I wondered if you wanted to share.
He, amazing. This was Wednesday night. He was to see the president on Thursday. Of course, we didn't know that. But the meeting was already set, so he'd already, I mean, stunning. Talked about, there was a lot of banter, very relaxed, talking about Princeton being the best university, and you know, this one, that. And serious talk about the Middle East. He had just come back from several of the countries there. He thought that long term, which even in the not very long term, that the country with the most possibility of success, Libya. Oil, as Mr. Spruce knows, and a relatively small population. So in spite of everybody focusing on Benghazi, he saw Libya as quite promising. And then Egypt. Well, anyway, we talked. You know, there was the discussion this way with our group. No, very very relaxed. Talked about how one gets information. Sometimes it's very easy. It's very public kind of information. Maybe it's your Facebooks or, God, you know, he never mentioned email. Never mentioned email. But he was relaxed, I thought. Rush, and, of course, he did walk away. didn't stay all night. But we had great meetings. I mean, great meetings with primarily focusing on the Middle East, some on energy. So that brought us around to fracking. Because to the amazement of Daniel Yergin, well, not maybe not to his amazement, but other experts in energy, you know, here the U.S. willy-nilly finds itself maybe energy independent. And of course, with this gas, one of the great aspects of gas is it's not so easily shipped, and therefore you have a great impact. He couldn't remember what the units were. I like that. When the head of the, maybe he had something on his mind, but the head of the CIA, he couldn't remember what the units were, but he knew that here the units are like $2.50 to $3 for this gas. I keep looking to Spruce because he knows all. And for gas here, it's down to $2.50 to $3. And in Japan, it's like $17 for that same unit. So he was trying to point out how the importance of energy for us. But then it was all Middle East, am I right? All Middle East. And I was disappointed that... you know, that Latin America wasn't part of the discussion, but I am sure it will be next year. I don't know. It's just some people. He's incredible. Cool, cool, cool. That's...
Ambassador, question. My name is Dr. Yeah. Romero.
Yes, sir.
And I'm a Cuban-American.
Mm-hmm.
And I just came from Cuba in March. I went with the Pope Benedictus XVI.
Oh, yes.
And in 1998, I went with Pope John Paul II. No? I saw a great change, you know, in Havana. People were very, very open to Americans.
Yes.
People were very open to our group. I'm a Knight of Malta, so the Pope asked us to escort him from Santiago de Cuba and Cobre to Havana. No.
Mm-hmm.
My question pertains I am also, I live here in San Antonio and also in Fredericksburg and also in Miami.
Mm-hmm.
And my question is the Cuban American community in Coral Gables, that you know they're very recalcitrant about the embargo. They want to go and recover their properties,
sure.
You know, and there are even lists of people that you register your properties, for example, my grandfather or whatever, that I want to recover them. And I wonder if the American government has some plans to deal with all those people that are looking forward to demise of Castro and the Castro brothers and the recovery of their properties and their goods in Havana.
Yeah, important question. By the way, I think a former colleague of mine and a guy who was principal officer in Havana, Jim Kazin, isn't he mayor of Coral Gables now?
Yes.
So that's kind of interesting how the guy who was, you know, the ambassador, the principal officer, that was his issue, and there he is. I really, I don't know the answer to all the plans that somebody might have. It just seems to me logical that as we move toward a relationship that works, and I'm not sure the embargo is held out. We're always holding out the embargo as a bargaining chip. I'm not sure it's a bargaining chip. You know, that's why we have people calling it stupid, because I think it's not good for us. But aside from that, there will be, with whatever committee comes out, whatever government comes out, close negotiations with rewards and penalties and so forth, dealing with that expropriation of lands that took place, what kind of compensation needs to be paid, and all of those somewhat complicated issues. I mean, it takes you down, in some sense, to the cadastro. I mean, what was the title? And do you really go back to the old house? I mean, these things are not, I think, they're generally not decided that way. I mean, in my own experience is looking at Bosnia and whatnot, where you had Bosniaks, as they call them, replaced. So those are the people, Muslims, but citizens of Bosnia, replaced by Serbs when the Serbs came in and took over. And then the Bosniaks go home and they want their house back. It's very complicated indeed. So I don't know how you deal with individual properties, but no doubt a very intricate negotiation will be taking place. And Cuba will obviously have to be in such a position to see the importance for them. And so there has to be income coming in. There has to be export, you know, lots of things that make it possible to make deals. And you know, you're the expert more than me, but that vote was very surprising. That is the youth in terms of our own government. Now, I don't know when the Obama administration will get around to something like the Cuba policy. And by the way, it's very family. Too. The head of the House Committee on Foreign Affairs is Eliana Rose Lehtinen, no? And so the House is very Republican. She can obviously stop any legislation. She's very much in favor of these things, the embargo and other tough legislation. So that will prevent the kind of change, I think, that comes through that legislation. But just to indicate, you know, again, better than that, how much family it is. So you've got your congressman. You had Lincoln Diaz-Balart, Mario Diaz-Balart. Who's their first cousin? Fidel Castro Jr. Fidelito is their first cousin. Fidel's first wife is their aunt. So the Diaz-Balarts. So, I mean, it's incredible how things are tied up. All politics local, I guess, and all enmity local as well. Yes, question? Catherine had. The World Affairs Council is great, I can tell you. The Washington group, this group, I mean, it's something that I'm really happy and thrilled to be a part of. Those issues we dealt with there, we'll deal again with here. We'll bring some of the guys here. We had Dennis Ross before, but bring him back. He may also have a big position. He's Mr. Israel-Palestine.
What a rich and interesting conversation. I know you all would have liked to have heard it go on and on. I apologize. But we're sticking with our time schedule, so I'm going to present Ambassador Cragen, this microphone is still acting up, with our special gift thanking him, And then when we break officially, please do stay and ask more questions. I know you've got lots more to ask. Hang on 1 second. We'd like to present you with something.
Uh-oh. Oh, thank you. This is our... See, can I get it out? Okay. U.S., Mexico, Central America, that's the key, that's the focus. Thank you very much.
Thank you for really a wonderful, wonderful presentation. Two very quick announcements. Reminder, December 3rd, Gender in the Middle East, Brightshaw, lunchtime. January 10th, a look at Taiwan, lunchtime. And I did miss introducing two board members, maybe because I was standing right next to them when I was in the middle of the room, but wanted to recognize Nancy Shivers at the table in the middle there, who is planning something very special for us program-wise. You'll be hearing more about it, but it's going to be great conversations where smaller groups of us can gather on a regular basis at the Liberty Bar to discuss many of these interesting things for fun, lower-key events. And also our vice chair, Connie McNabb, sitting at the same table, who is the chair of this year's International Citizens Award Dinner. And Connie, as a finale, would you stand up at that microphone right by you and give everyone hot off the press who our honoree and speaker will be this year, next year?
Well, we hope everyone will be able to join us. This is a little low. Hope everyone will be able to join us March 6th, 2013, as we honor Dick Evans, CEO of Frost Bank. We're so excited to have him as our international citizen honoree, and also thrilled that the speaker will be Richard Fisher from the Dallas Fed. So it should be a great night. Mark your calendars, and we hope you'll all join us.
Thank you all for coming. The meeting is adjourned.